Hello and welcome to Formula Y, the official Formula One podcast dedicated to explaining how the brilliant world of F1 works. I'm Katie Osborne.
And I'm Christian Hugill. Now, normally, Formula Y answers one big question about the sport every week. But every now and then, we dive into our listener postbag. Their emails. It's not really a postbag, but you know what we mean.
I wish it was.
I wish there was too. That would be great. We've sort of missed that by 15 years. Anyway, I'm being distracted. Every now and then, we dive into our imaginary digital postbag and put some of your quickfire questions to two F1 experts.
That's right. Send us your questions and your voice notes. I love a good voice note. To whyw@f1.com. Drop us an email and you could hear yourself on the podcast. Now, this is your second Your Whys Answered. We're putting just some of the hundreds of questions you've sent us to our experts.
They are former chief strategist at Aston Martin, Bernie Collins, and F1.com correspondent and F1 TV presenter, Lawrence Barreto, also known for having the best collection of jazzy trainers in Formula One, as we learned in part one. He has 75 pairs. Where does he keep them?
I'm just wondering how he packs his shoes to his races. That's what I... Anyway. We have learned... We learned much more than just that in part one. So go back and give it a listen when you have time. But for now, let's dive back into those questions. And the next one is about race strategy for Bernie. It's from David Barclay. And David says, can you please explain how the undercut and overcut works and why they're so important? We did have a similar question from Lori Stone in Rancho Palos Verdes, California. They wanted to know about the overcut.
They are great questions that I get asked all the time. So let's start with what exactly is the undercut and overcut?
Yeah, so hi, David. Thanks for your question. So it's really, there's a few ways that cars try and gain position to try and overtake another car. Now, the most obvious one is just to overtake on track in a corner and zone or whatever. But the other way is through the pit stops. So teams try and choose their pit stops such that at the end of the pit stop, they're ahead of another car. So if we think of two cars driving along together, so car A in front is slower than car B behind, but car B can't go past. So the methods to try and get past are for the second car, the B car that's quicker, to stop early. So it stops first, and then when it comes out of its pit stop, it has a full lap in clean air. And what it's trying to do in that lap is use the new tyres and the better car pace anyway to make sure that when the car that was ahead stops, it comes out behind. And that's what's called the undercut. So the undercut is basically any time that a car behind stops first and then emerges ahead of the car that originally was ahead of it. And that could be done in one lap or it could be over several laps. The overcut is the opposite way around. So again, you still have a car A and a car B ahead, but the car in front stops first. And that means that the car behind now has still got clear air when the first car stops. And it extends the stint, so it's running in the clear air, although still on the old tyres. And what it's trying to do is be quicker in those laps before it does its pit stop than the car that's come out on track. And the reasons for that might be the tyres improving, the car was quicker anyway, or the new tyres that the car A has fitted are too slow, they're suffering warm up, or he's got stuck in traffic or whatever it might be. And that's the overcut. So the overcut being any point where the car behind has stayed on track and done more laps than another car, but still managed to emerge ahead. Now, the typical example in F1 is the undercut, because the degradation on a tyre means that at the end of the stint, it's very hard to be fast enough to overcut generally, unless you've got a much stronger car pace. So we tend to see the undercut more often than we see an overcut.
A classic example of an undercut is Sebastian Vettel at the 2019 Singapore Grand Prix. Sebastian was running third in his Ferrari behind Mercedes Lewis Hamilton in second and the other Ferrari of Charles Leclerc, who was leading the race. Seb was faster than the two drivers ahead of him, but he wasn't able to overtake. Overtaking is really hard in Singapore because the track's quite narrow. So effectively, he was stuck behind Leclerc and Hamilton, unable to drive as fast as he wanted to.
Yeah. Sebastian Vettel coming in.
Vettel pits.
That's right, and Vettel pitted from third on lap 20. He came out in clean air, which means he didn't have anyone in front of him, no one to slow him down so he could drive completely flat out. Those brand new tires he'd just put on gave him maximum grip and maximum speed. Leclerc stopped a lap later on lap 21, but Sebastian's pace had been so strong on that lap, on those new tires, that he leapfrogged his teammate.
Well, Vettel's going to get ahead of Leclerc here, and he is.
I thought he would. I don't think Vettel's pit stop was that slow. He's undercut him. It's cost track position for Leclerc.
So Vettel, by doing the undercut and pitting earlier, had the chance to unleash his full pace, and that got him ahead of his teammate. Lewis Hamilton, meanwhile, tried the overcut. He stayed out six laps longer than Vettel. The hope was, as Bernie just said, he'd be able to go faster in clean air, even though his tyres were worn, and jump ahead of Leclerc. But on that day, it didn't work.
Lewis Hamilton stops. You can see the Ferraris in the distance and Max Verstappen coming round the final corner. 2.4 seconds in the stationary zone. It's not even close. He's miles behind.
And that was crucial for the race. Sebastian Vettel's undercut took him from P3 to P1, and that is where he stayed. He held on to the lead for the rest of the Grand Prix, getting what would turn out to be his last race win in Formula One.
Sebastian Vettel takes the checkered flag and wins the Singapore Grand Prix.
There's going to be some interesting conversations after the race, because obviously Charles Leclerc feels that's been snatched away from him, but the strategy, choices they took, Vettel's made it work.
And Bernie, that sort of thing is where strategists are doing the overtaking, right? That's your brain coming into its own to help the driver overtake. That must be a nice satisfying moment of life as a strategist.
Well, yeah, it is and it isn't, because I'd imagine post-race there was very few drivers claiming that we'd managed to do very many overtakes. But it is one of those things where you're watching lots of data, you're watching the lap times really carefully to make sure that your lap time is improving by enough that the overcut's going to work. And then you're trying to... It becomes this point where you're trying not to be too greedy. So you need a little bit of margin on your pit stop in case you have a slow pit stop. So maybe you think within one lap you're going to be ahead, and then you're like, oh, do we risk it and stay out a second lap? But is the other car that we're trying to come out in front of going to get quicker suddenly, or are we going to hit some traffic? So it becomes this really delicate balance of extending the stint and gaining a bit more margin on your pit stop and not taking too much for granted, because anything could go wrong at any time. But it is quite a satisfying feeling when you've made the call right to stay out and not stop too early. And, you know, the overcut is, if you can make it work, always safer, because then even in the final stint, you've got fresher tyres than the other guy because you stop later. So it's always really satisfying if you can get it to work and you sort of feel like you've nailed the decision then.
Well done, Bernie. David, hope that helps. And good news, Katie Osborne, we've got another voice note.
Hey, Formula Y, this is Colin from Des Moines, Iowa, USA. Just curious to see, what does it take to become part of the crew in Formula One? How does a strategist become a strategist? How does a team principal become a team principal? Love to hear your thoughts.
If only we had a strategist. Go on, Bernie. How does a strategist become a strategist?
I think it's really interesting because I've spoke to lots of people who are really keen to get into F1 and know they've always wanted to work in F1, and that wasn't necessarily the route I took. I did an engineering degree and then I started to work in the design office of F1, designing different components. So there's lots of different routes in. I would say the typical route for most of the engineering department that you see at the track or in the design offices in the factory have been sort of engineering degrees, or a lot more now apprenticeships, and then trying to build up and get experience in a design office or working in motorsport or automotive. So the strategists then, some strategists are just pure mathematics degrees. Some are, like myself, engineering degrees. And then working through, I did a lot in sort of junior series, as we call it, so single-seater or sports cars, in order to build up trackside knowledge and then just working towards the track in F1. A lot of the mechanics have again worked in sort of those junior series, so the GT3s of the world or whatever, trying to gain experience and work their way to the trackside experience in F1. Team principals, I'm not sure, because I've not got there yet.
But they know somebody who knows somebody, huh?
Yeah. But I think a lot of it, like all industry, is just working within the office, working within the industry, gain an experience of different parts of the groups and departments, and then gradually working your way up through the office to, you know, that sort of environment?
Well, firstly, I just want to say, Bernie, I'm all for you becoming a team principal, that you said not team principal yet. So I'm glad
you heard it first here on Formula Y.
So on the team principal side of things, I'm pretty lucky that I get to talk to a lot of them in my day job, and they come from all different backgrounds. And I think that's particularly exciting if you do work in Formula One, because it means there's no like standard formula. Like Günther Steiner, yes, okay, he had some experience working in rallying and was the technical director at Red Bull, but he only became the team principal at Haas because he found the money to bring the team into Formula One, and then Gene Haas made him the team boss. So that's like one way of doing it. Mattia Binotto, he was an engineer, he spent 20 years at Ferrari before he became technical director, and then he was promoted into the team principal role. And then you've got people like Fred Vasseur, who was team boss in the lower categories, who then had the opportunity to step it up in Formula One with Renault, Sauber, and now he's obviously the Ferrari team boss. And then Toto Wolff, okay, yeah, he did some racing really early on in his career, but he kind of entered as a businessman, and he bought into Williams, then sold that share and bought a share in Mercedes, became their team principal, and then took over all of their motorsport activities. So there is no like clear cut way of doing it, other than you've just got to be pretty shrewd, got to have a good business head on you, be able to run a company, because these team bosses run between 200, 600, 700, 800 people. So you've got to be able to manage that kind of group of people and also take that responsibility. But I think what's great is there's no one size fits all.
And Lawrence, you're right. Because another interesting recent example is James Vowles, who's only recently become team principal of Williams. Now, he actually, I understand, did a master's degree in motorsport engineering and management. Most of his F1 experience was in engineering. He was the chief strategist of Braun GP in 2009, where, of course, they so famously won the world championship with Jenson Button. He then went on to work in Mercedes, again, not dissimilar to Bernie, to your field of engineering and strategy, before being given the opportunity to step up and be a team boss with Williams. So, yeah, again, no real one-size-fits-all policy.
Christian, and picking up to that, you have, you know, people like Zach Brown and Jost Capito of last year, Williams, you're mentioning, who came in from so many different outlets. Like, Jost was overseeing Volkswagen Rally, World Rally, and the concept that I find being in motorsports myself is that it's not just limited to these experience in F1 and you climb up the ladder. So to being a part of crew, like there's plenty of people who have been on crews in IndyCar or have been covering PR in IndyCar or in NASCAR or stateside, and then they happen to make the jump over to F1 and vice versa. And I think that's an important thing to keep in mind too, that it's not just getting in the door in the early stages of Formula One and some of what, you know, working your way up that ladder. There's other ladders on the side that people notice you and your performance in motorsport, similar to a Jost or others who have been involved on teams, that they then jump into Formula One because of what they have done in other forms of motorsports.
And Lawrence, there'll be a lot of people really interested from a sort of journalism and broadcasting side. Obviously, Lawrence, you're, as we mentioned at the start of this episode, your job is your correspondent for F1.com, you're a reporter and presenter on F1 TV. How did you get into this world of sort of journalism and broadcasting in Formula One, Lawrence?
So I had a more of a route one into journalism, in that I just did a journalism degree at Bournemouth, but I kind of tried to work across a lot of different sports, across a different like publications. So I did magazines, I did digital media, I did broadcasting, I covered the London 2012 Olympics, I've covered Wimbledon tennis, and then the core was always Formula One. So it was just a case of building up experience, making my way into the paddock on my university magazine and meeting people that I'm still working with today. Like I work, Will Buxton, who I commentate with, I met when I did a Bridgestone e-reporter competition in 2006. So like nearly 20 years ago, and now I'm working together with him. So I think it's just about trying hard, relying on people to give you the opportunity, working hard and learning your craft. And then you can find a way in, and just find an area that you really enjoy doing. Like I like talking to people, I like talking about Formula One, so I found a job where I get to do two of my favorite things.
And Lawrence is very good at that job, trust me, my friend.
Absolutely.
Katie, you've got another question for us.
Yeah, we have another email question from Mark Kovach in Louisville, Kentucky. He says, I've been watching F1 for over 5 years. My question is why do the cars have red taillights? Why is it important? And why does that change when it's raining? Bernie.
We see a lot of feedback, let's say, about the lack of visibility in a Formula One car. So the rain in question is actually the easiest in that it is just an indication of how far the gap is to the car in front. Because sometimes with the spray, it's really, really difficult for the guys to see. So that is just a safety precaution that in the rain, it's a flashing rain light effectively. You know, it's a requirement, a legal requirement of the regulations that it works in the rain and a car can be stopped if it's not working. So that is just a safety concern, such that the guys driving can see how close they are to the car in front, particularly in those braking zones. It also, and I think maybe we come on to it in a bit, but when a car is entering a corner, it's not a brake light, so it doesn't show where they're braking. But before the corner, when the engine stops deploying or starts to harvest, as we call it, it starts to indicate that although it's too early for the braking zone because drivers know where they expect the car ahead to start to brake, they might start to lose straight line speed. And that's just an indication that the car in front is starting to slow, although not necessarily braking.
Bernie, you just mentioned harvesting. Carolyn asks, can you explain the process of harvesting when a driver is close behind another driver? What does harvesting mean, Bernie?
So if we think that these cars now are hybrid cars, which basically means they have an element of battery power within them. So on a straight, typically, particularly early in the straight, the cars are deploying that battery. So they're using that saved energy in order to get the quickest straight line speed as quickly as they possibly can. So it's most efficient to use that at the start of the straight. Towards the end of the straight then, before the driver brakes, or particularly if he's following another car closely, the car behind is actually saving energy because of the car in front, because the car in front's braking through the air, if you like. So the car behind can start to harvest a little bit more. So build up its battery power because it's not using, it doesn't need to use it at that point. You often see as well drivers using it very strategically around the lap. So for example, the car in front, if he's defending position, often you see drivers looking in their mirrors and saying, I know I'm safe from the car behind, so I can actually harvest a little bit now. So it's just build up that battery power a little bit, such that you're not wasting all the energy and braking in the corner. Now, a lot of the times the cars do it automatically, so they have got a map within the car that says, these are the points in the lap that we're going to deploy the energy, and these are the points in the lap where we're going to harvest the energy, and it needs to balance throughout the lap or throughout the race. And then additionally to that, the drivers have a button where either they can deploy a little bit more energy or harvest a little bit more if they think they don't need the deployment. So there's a combination of both this automatic and the driver influence on when they're deploying or using the battery.
Is a driver aware of when they're going to do this prior to getting in the race car? Does he do this without the team's knowledge and decides to do it and then radios back to say, hey, by the way, I've just pushed the button? Or is this part of the plan A, B, C, D, and Z that we hear about that someone has to remember in the mix?
It's a bit of a combination. So through the Friday practice sessions, the engine department or the engine engineers might have set up different versions of the map. So you might have more deployment on the main straight, or, you know, different selections that the driver can choose. And the driver gets to learn what those selections are and how best to use them. So you might use one that's optimum for qualifying. You might use one that's optimum for defending. So the driver will know in the car which switch positions they are. And then as they press the buttons, all of that information comes back to the pit wall. So the engineers on the pit wall are aware. So at times you will hear the pit wall say things like, you can only use the overtake one more time this lap, or you can only use that for the next three laps in that way, because they can see that they're going to run out of the battery level. And it sounds really simple, but on their steering wheel, the drivers will have an indication, just like it's on your phone, that says where the battery level is. And they can keep track a little bit of whether they're too close to the bottom of the battery or if they've got loads of energy left. So over the practice sessions and over time, they'll get used to where's the right place for their battery to be in.
And the battery effectively gives them a little boost, doesn't it? Which they most typically use when overtaking, but it's effectively a little bit of a boost button.
Exactly.
Right. This is a great question from Kevin J. I really enjoy this one. It's an email question. He says, hi, Formula One. I noticed when watching coverage of Free Practice 1 and Free Practice 2 for the Saudi Arabian Grand Prix that every time they showed a car entering the pit lane, it sounded like someone was blowing on a whistle. Why? Does that happen at every track? Is it a warning or alert to the teams? Wouldn't the roaring of an engine of an approaching F1 car be warning enough? Thank you. Enjoy the pod from Kevin. Lawrence, I really enjoy this question. You've been in your fair share of pit lanes. Answer this one for Kevin.
Well, I would say that I'm very glad for the marshal who is blowing the whistle as much as he is doing it, because a pit lane, especially a live pit lane when the cars are running through, is a pretty dangerous place if you're not keeping your eyes open. There's a lot going on. You've got guys using wheel guns, creating loud noises, cars doing fire-ups, cars out on the track. There's just a lot of noise going on. So yeah, while a car is very loud as it's approaching a pit lane, it's moving pretty quickly, and that wouldn't be enough time. That if you're, say, crossing the road to get to, say, the pit wall, that wouldn't be enough time. So essentially a whistle's going off just to alert people, give them the earliest warning that a car is about to enter the pit lane. So you've got marshals, you've got engineers, you've got photographers, FIA personnel, you've got lots of people in the pit lane, and it's just an opportunity for them to get a reminder that a car is coming, and just to be a bit more alert.
Another reason why the whistle is so helpful is because the pit's obviously next to, more often than not, the start finish straight. So differing between the engine noise of the car going down the start finish straight and the whistle, it's really handy, because they're still moving really fast in the pit lane. Like, it's still effectively like being stood on the side of a motorway. Like, it is such a busy, loud experience. It's like nothing I've ever experienced in a pit lane before. Katie, you've got the next question, and we had the same question in from both Rob and from Garrett.
Yeah, I thought this was really interesting. Why do drivers look at screens when they're sitting in their cars in the garage? What are they looking at? Bernie, you kind of mentioned buttons and pushing different things. It's not like an entertainment package like we all know on motorway cars.
Yeah, sure. So it depends a little bit on the session, but typically what they're looking at is what we call an overlay. Now, what an overlay does is it shows for, let's say, a lap in like a qualifying session or a practice session, when the driver's accelerating, when it's braking, when he's braking, it'll show things like steering angle, and it'll show his speed at each point through the lap. So typically what the driver will be looking at is what he's done on his last lap versus, let's say, what the driver next door to him, so the other driver in the same car, what he's done. And they'll be looking for differences. And what they're trying to say is, where can I, as a driver, improve? So is the guy next to me braking 5 metres later into a corner? Is he doing a slightly different thing with his steering line? Whatever it might be. They also might look at things like compares, what they did across two laps. So maybe they tried something different on a lap and they're checking to see if it worked or not and why. So all the time they're looking at trying to see how they can get the quickest lap time. And that's probably a combination of what both drivers are doing. They may look at a host of other things. So sometimes the teams will provide them, like, this is a map of what the wind's doing in each corner, so that in advance of the lap, they can get ready for what sort of wind conditions they expect. Or, yeah, there's a whole variety of things. The engine mapping that we talked about a minute ago, they could maybe look at, okay, he's using his energy somewhere slightly different to me. So what effect is that having through the lap? So generally, they're looking at compares of what a different driver is doing in order to help them improve their lap time.
If I was listening to our podcast, I would have sent this question in via voice note, is how do these drivers remember the plans A, B, C down to Z in their head while they're driving? And are they reminded on another radio, perhaps, that, you know, as TV and comms, we don't have access to?
So I think that all of the radio that is said between the pit wall and the driver is live, so none of that's hidden. So even the other teams can have that information, like not just alone the TV or the people at home watching live. So that's why teams are pretty careful about what they say. So we try to say plan A plus 5 laps, for example, and we tend to make the plans quite simple. So let's say you've got, you know, you want your plan A to be lap 19 or whatever, you might just make it 20 because it's a nice round number and it's easier to remember potentially than 19. So you try and make it as easy as you can for the drivers to remember. We personally only ever did, you know, sort of a plan A, B, C. So we didn't have, you know, loads of letters or plans available. Some drivers will have like a little note in their car, like literally a little sticker on the inside of the chassis somewhere that they can read their plans. There's loads of ways that drivers remember. And we do have like several meetings on a Saturday night, several meetings on a Sunday morning where we discuss it over and over. So they're pretty on top of what the plans mean, I think. And I'm always amazed by how much they can take in of their surroundings. Like so many times drivers have come back and said, oh, I seen this on the TV. And you sort of feel like, wow, you know, you're doing like 300 kilometres per hour. Like, how have you got time to like look outside the car at the TV?
That's what I wonder about. Yeah, even looking exactly. at the stickers in the car. That to me is mind blowing of like trying to focus and drive and read and think and process and keep your car straight.
I think versus what I can do, like even in my road car, you know, the awareness that they have is phenomenal. And that's just because they're so good at what they do. So I think, yeah, they're more on top of it than, you know, you think is possible.
Two great examples of that, Bernie, from the same man at the same Grand Prix, Fernando Alonso. The first is that he got slightly confused with his strategies in the middle of the Miami Grand Prix and said, we're looking, aren't we, at plan A minus 12. And the team think, minus 12? That's a lot of laps. Fortunately, they knew what he meant and he was merging plan A with plan B. But the team just were so on it that they knew what he meant. Oh, he means that, which is amazing. And the second is that in the Miami Grand Prix, Fernando admitted that he was watching some of his teammate Lance Stroll's overtakes from the big screen. And in the post-race interviews, I was covering that race for the BBC in the UK, and in the post-race interviews, I said to him, Fernando, those screens are for the fans, not for the drivers. You're aware of that? And he was like, oh, it was a big screen and I could see what was going on. So yeah, Fernando Alonso never ceases to amaze us. Right, two more. The penultimate question is from Michelle Bloom. She says, dear Formula Y, why are team principals also allowed to be managers of other F1 drivers outside their own team? And are there rules and regulations in place to prevent this situation from becoming a conflict of interest to their own team as well as other teams on the grid? So a little example of this is Toto Wolff at Mercedes, who's also Valtteri Bottas' manager. So, who, of course, used to drive for Mercedes. So how does this work?
Yeah, I think it is very complicated. I think it's a bit like, if we think of it as just an industry, there are lots of executives at the top of different industries that will have, you know, shares, for example, in another company. For a long time, you know, Toto was running Mercedes, but, you know, had shares in Aston Martin or in Williams, for example. And different things like you kind of Mercedes engine, but supplying different teams on the grid. So there's conflicts there. So I think it's managed a lot by the legal departments in that particular team. But a lot of these sort of high-end executives have interests in other things outside. And ultimately, often the team managers aren't maybe the people who are definitely involved in the driver discussions. And there's a lot of legal work around that as well. Sometimes it stems from, you know, the Bottas is a good example where he obviously was at Mercedes and then left Mercedes and now Toto is managing him, you know, I believe he's not going to go back to Mercedes. It happens a lot with young drivers in particular, where a manager may have a young driver that they believe they're going to bring into their young driver scheme. Or we've had it in the past where drivers have managed other drivers that are young drivers, or ex-drivers have managed young drivers. So there is a lot of potential conflicts going on there, but it's how they manage that to get the best out of the team. You know, ultimately, if Toto brought Bottas back into the team and globally Mercedes didn't think it was the right thing to do, Toto wouldn't retain his job for very long. But he is trying to use his experience in order to help Bottas in other ways. So there is a lot of management going on around it in order to make sure the team's protected and the driver's protected.
Yeah, thank you for diving in a little deeper into that. Lawrence, finally, Clemoyne says, I'm excited that Ford is going to be joining F1 in 2026. I think there's lots of people who are excited Ford's joining. I'm curious why it's such a long time frame for them to join. And also, what will Ford's involvement be on the Red Bull team?
So I think if you were to ask people at Ford or actually other manufacturers, that's not enough time really to be getting ready to come into Formula One in 2026. They firstly chosen 2026 because we're going to have a sweeping new set of engine regulations, which will have a greater focus on the use of 100% sustainable fuels. that kind of buys into Formula One's message of trying to be net zero by 2030, and they're going to have a greater focus on the electrical side of things, on the battery. So when you have a big change in rules like this, it's much easier for a new manufacturer to come in from the outside and not feel like they're starting from so far back, because obviously Mercedes, Ferrari, Renault, they've been in the sport for a long time. They've got constant development. They're looking at dyno work, you know, engines on test beds in the factories, and they're doing so much work day in, day out, that it's quite hard for someone new to come in and then try and be on a level playing field. So Ford have done two things. They've picked the new regulations to give them the best chance to do that, and they've teamed up with Red Bull, who have got their own powertrains division that they've started building up a couple of years ago, and have already got an engine testing on a test bed, a V6 engine testing on a test bed. So that means that Ford are going to come in, and they're not going to not only start on the front foot, but they're going to be with a very powerful engine manufacturer, have recruited a lot of people from rival teams like Mercedes, and they'll be working on this engine going forward. What are Ford specifically going to do? Well, they say they're going to work on the battery cell area, on this electric motor technology, and on the software around the power unit control electronics, and the analytics and that kind of thing. So they'll be using their expertise from their global automotive business to kind of tap into Formula One through that. Whereas Red Bull will provide the Formula One experience. They've got all of those years working recently with Honda as well, and they'll work together to try and create an engine that hopefully will do the opposite of what Honda did when they came into Formula One and struggled for 4, 5, 6 years, is they'll hopefully hit the ground running when they enter in 2026.
So will this make a big impact on Red Bull's performance? Obviously, there's lots of changes that are unknown, but having a partnership like Ford, is it a gamble for them to go in on something like this?
I think actually it's only a win-win situation, because they get the backing of a global automotive manufacturer and all of the funds that come with it. They get access to all of their tech and their expertise in the areas where potentially they have the weaknesses, which is around the battery and the control software. And what they do have, Red Bull, is all of this know-how from Formula One. So really, it's the best of both worlds. Of course, when you've got someone else coming in and they'll have their own ideas, you might get a butting of heads, because Red Bull will believe they do it the right way. Ford will come in and go, well, we've got ideas, why don't you listen to us? So there might be a bit of friction there. But actually, generally speaking, if they both work and pull in the same direction, actually, it could be best for both worlds.
Does it change the name? Is there going to be Ford's Red Bull?
Yeah, it's going to be Red Bull Powertrains Ford.
As the Constructor Championship goes, that's what we'll see on the line.
Yeah, so you'll see Red Bull Powertrains Ford, yeah.
We'll get that down by 2026.
A catchy name there, I think we can all agree. Now, we've had emails from Jay Carlson in Arlington, Texas, from Dennis McBride, and also from Justine Cunningham about F1 Sprint. Lots of questions about that. We've already answered them. If you haven't already, go and listen to episode 1, where we answer everything you could possibly wish to know about F1 Sprint. And if we haven't answered your question on one of these quick fire podcasts, it might be because we've decided to do a whole episode on your question. So keep listening, and we would love to hear your voice. So send us your questions, but particularly send us your voice notes. Why? Because as we all know by now, Katie Osborne likes a voice note. Send us your voice to ywhy@f1.com. Tell us where you're from. Tell us what you think of the podcast as well. And we look forward to hearing from you.
And of course, if you're a little bit shy, totally respect that. Send it via email. We're all good with that too. Thank you, Lawrence and Bernie, for your time, your efforts. This has been such a joy and a treat to not only get to know you two a little bit more, but obviously answer some of these questions. And Christian, you and I learning along the way as well.
Oh, I learned so much from their massive F1 brains. It was fantastic. And if you want even more, you can check out Bernie's brilliant Strategy Unpacked articles on F1.com. There's plenty of articles from Lawrence on there too, as well as his excellent shoes and himself being on F1 TV every race weekend.
Yeah, you can follow him on socials to really get the full flair of his outfits. Of course, there's also F1 Nation and F1 Beyond the Grid podcasts that are open for all F1 ears. And next Friday, you can join us for an all-new episode of Formula Y.
That is right. And Lawrence, thank you very much. Great to talk to you.
Thanks very much for having me. I'll be back with more shoe chat whenever you need me.
We will take you up on that offer. Bernie, thoroughly enjoyed your company. Thank you.
Yes, it's great to be back talking to you both.
Me and Katie will be back next week. Bye for now.